As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. Without question, the interview of the day. I will cut to the chase. There's exactly one book to read to catch up with the changes in China. It is The Third Revolution, and it is by Elizabeth Economy. Of course, she changed our dialogue with China with The River Runs Black. That was just a few years ago. Liz Economy with the Council on Foreign Relations. Professor Economy, good morning. Wonderful to have you with us. What is The Third Revolution right now for President Xi? He's got some challenges. How's that Third Revolution going?
So, you know, the Third Revolution for Xi Jinping was really upending the period of reform and opening up that Deng Xiaoping had ushered in some 30 years earlier, and creating a China that was far more repressive and authoritarian at home, but more ambitious and expansive abroad, right? It was his great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. I think what we're seeing today is that, you know, over the past 6 years, this model has produced its own set of fairly profound challenges for Xi Jinping. You know, there's a great sense of political malaise in the country because of his grab for power, his elimination of the two-term limit on the presidency, 150 Xi Jinping, institutes for Xi Jinping thought. People feel as though there's been, to some extent, a return to that Maoist era cult of personality, and they don't want to go back to that, right? Constraints on the internet, the intrusion of the Communist Party, you know, into private enterprises and in more deeply into people's lives. So I think he's created his own set of problems through this third revolution.
Within his third revolution, there has to be a Communist Party on one page. As he goes to this People's Congress, is his 400 or whatever the body count is, Politburo leaders, are they all on the same page, or is there a huge dissent?
So this is the Communist Party meeting, the Party Congress happens in the fall. This is the National People's Congress, so there are actually 3,000 people meeting in Beijing right now for 2 weeks. And I think there are many dissenting views, and I think part of it has to do with the failure to move forward on structural economic reform. So there's a lot of discontent over, again, Xi Jinping's tightening up and his preferencing of state-owned enterprises over private enterprise. So a lot of dissent around that. There's concern around Xi Jinping's anti-corruption campaign, right? The lack of transparency in that and, lack of rule of law. They had over 600,000 officials were punished last year for corruption. That's 100,000 more than the year before. There are many areas of unhappiness.
But does he go into this 3,000 member Congress where everybody claps at the same time? I know you monitor the clapping volume, but beneath that is 400, then 200, then 6 members of the Politburo and all the other subsets that there are. Are they in support of their president?
I think we've seen, you know, over the last summer, there was a lot of discussion about a dissent within the standing committee of the Politburo, right? As you said, the sort of the top, very top, 7-person group that Xi Jinping was being sort of accused of overreach. right, that he had created all these problems with the United States, you know, facing this trade war, that there were problems, you know, through the Belt and Road Project. A lot of countries now are, you know, staying or even canceling projects, these big infrastructure projects that they had agreed to with China. Obviously, the Chinese economy was slowing, and they didn't seem to have a game plan. He wasn't listening to the reform economists, and, you know, he kept wanting to double down on state control. So I think all throughout the system, there is dissent and discontent.
So what is the experience you've seen in their history of what's next? What's the process forward for a totalitarian regime given this dissent?
So I think if the economy continues to slow, right now what we're seeing is, you know, some small movements toward economic reform. I think Xi Jinping was kind of pushed into a corner and forced to make a statement a few months back about the need to enhance the role of the market, which is not his inclination. So we have to see whether or not there actually some of these reform initiatives move forward. If they do, if the economy begins to kick back in, then I think economic growth kicks back in, and I think Xi Jinping is okay. If it doesn't, I don't expect that they would remove Xi Jinping, but I think you could see what happened to Mao Zedong after the Great Leap Forward in the early 1960s, which is he was moved to the second line, right? Because and basically what that says is Xi Jinping is no longer first.
Have you among equals? Dr. Economy, have you identified the next Zhou Enlai? I mean, it's great to talk about Mao and Xi, but who comes in to save the day?
Well, unfortunately, the three, I think, within the standing committee are not particularly strong. There's Li Keqiang and Wang Yang and Han Jiang. They're sort of the three that, you know, could potentially do something. But this would be more of a consensus decision that we're going back to the Dengist model of collective and consensus-based decision-making. It's not necessarily that one leader moves in to replace Xi in the way that Xi has grabbed onto power, but that they go back to the sense that no one person stands above the rest.
If you're just joining us, CV Star Fellow, the Council on Foreign Relations, Elizabeth Economy, I can't say enough about her effort, The Third Revolution. I read it cover to cover. You should, too. One of the great theories that we saw from The River Runs Black and onward, Liz Economy, is the power of the cities. What is the relationship of President Xi and Beijing to the people that actually run Shanghai, run Hong Kong, run Chengdu and the others?
Nice. So one of the really interesting things that's happened over the past year, year and a half, is that we've seen repeated calls by Xi Jinping, by Li Keqiang, for local officials to implement Beijing's policies. There seems to be an incredible reluctance on the part of local officials to do what Beijing says. I think it's because the mandates come down. There are so many different mandates, and sometimes they conflict, right? So first you have a mandate, you know, to stop lending, right? Then you have a mandate, no, actually start lending again. You have a mandate to protect the environment. Now just in the past 2 months, they've said, actually, our targets are too ambitious. We're going to take a step back in protecting the environment. And, of course, the anti-corruption campaign, which has caused many local officials really not to want to take risks. They don't want to be noticed by Beijing and then somehow, you know, draw attention to themselves and perhaps come under some kind of corruption claim. So I think right now the situation for Beijing is very dire. Well, they have a lot of resistance at the local level.
To vamp off the not-so-new normal, Chapter 4 of the Third Revolution, right now, what's the not-so-new normal for President Trump? What's the to-do list for America as they address these uncertainties in China?
I think this administration is leaving no stone unturned. It's pretty extraordinary, I have to say. It's across the full range of issues, whether we're talking the security front or the trade front, or even the political front, right? Chinese influence operations, what's going on in Xinjiang in terms of the repression of the, you know, Uyghur Muslim population there. The administration is firing like on all pistons. We have to see what the end result is, but I would say that they really are trying to hold the Chinese feet to the fire, so to speak, and get some movement in a way that I think reflects American interests you know, more directly.
It was my book of the summer last year, The Third Revolution, Elizabeth Economy. My book of the summer this year is Raghuram's new The Third Pillar, which I know Liz will read cover to cover, as I will too. But do yourself a favor, redo The Third Revolution 1 year on. It is still an exceptionally prescient dissertation on the new China. And of course, with these new announcements, you heard there the urgency from Dr. Economy. Liz Economy, thank you so much with the Council on Foreign Relations.
We begin then with our top story, China lowering its goal for economic growth and announcing a major tax cut as policymakers seek to pull off a gradual deceleration with a grappling of a trade story and a debt legacy as well. I want to bring in Bloomberg's David Inglis for more. He joins us live from Beijing. So, David, they replaced the target with a growth range. Walk me through it.
Right, 6 to 6.5%. The growth last year overall was 6.6%. So the first top line is there is an acknowledgement among the top leadership that growth will slow this year. For investors who were fearing that growth might slip below 6%, this obviously adds a little bit, maybe a floor to growth. More importantly, though, it's the type of growth that they want to pursue. When you look at the tax cuts that they mentioned, $300 billion it's worth of tax cuts and social security fees. And essentially what they're doing is there's been some challenges really in terms of lending money to the private sector. So in a lot of ways, what they're doing is they're leaving more money on the table in the pockets of the private sector and people, and hopefully turn around the consumption story that was quite horrible last year.
David, does the range also just tell you how uncertain things are for the future of the Chinese economy?
It certainly does. I think when you try and quantify what 6 to 6.5% is and the difference there, it's a $13 trillion economy. So that's anywhere from a rough estimate that's about $90 billion to maybe $300 billion worth of output that may or may not be there. So essentially what they're trying to do, and really when it comes to the party, I had a look at the report, 40 pages, font size 12. It's a work report. It's the first time they mention explicitly that everything they're throwing at the growth problem right now is really meant to protect jobs and employment. Yeah. And when it comes to the party, it's really all about social stability.
Well, there is the Communist Party, and then there's the National People's Congress. By my count, it's 2,900 warm bodies in the room clapping on cue. Great. What percentage of those people support President Xi?
That's the big question. In fact, a lot of the things that we heard today from the work report and a lot of the things that essentially you'll hear the next 10 days or so. Tomorrow, Wednesday, Asian time, you'll have the economic planner coming up with their own press conference. You have the Commerce Ministry the day after that, the PBOC, what has all these ministries. A lot of the things that you'll hear were decided back in October during the plenum. It is the Communist Party, of course, and what they say essentially is likely what will likely happen. The other piece really to that story as well is really them moving the economy from one that is centrally planned, state-owned, into one, of course, where you have more private enterprise. And the tricky part, and the reason I bring that up, is when they talk about, oh, we need to get capital through to the private enterprises. Well, guess what? A lot of the people that we talk to say, you look at the structure of the Chinese banking system, it's not really designed yet to service the private sector. So really, that's one area to watch in how they actually manage to gradually moderate the economy to where they want it to be.
Hey, David, great to catch up with you. Bloomberg's David Inglis joining us live from Beijing as we get a new growth range from the Chinese government.
Let's talk to someone from Britain who only thinks in centigrade. Actually, she went to the University of Maine, where it's colder than cold a good part of the year. Good morning up in Orono. Listening, Marianne Schneider-Petzinger joins us right now, and this is to get briefed on China. Liz Economy to join us later on. Marianne, what struck me about the Chinese announcement was the all-in sense of it. Is it a point of crisis for the leadership of the Communist Party, or is this an evolutionary path that they're on to some new policy?
I think we're certainly seeing an evolutionary phase for a lot will still happen, and certainly also with implications for what it means for the U.S. economy. Also, you know, on the U.S.-China front, there are sources that say we're close to a potential trade deal, that we're in the final stages. But again, you know, even if we're at the finishing line, are we at the finishing line of a 100-meter hurdle race, or is this really much more about a marathon? And I think it's about those long-term issues.
You absolutely nailed the immediacy of the trade deal. Was this document written for the trade deal discussion, or do they look at, does Beijing look at the trade deal separate from the 7, 8, 9 menu items they came out with for the National People's Congress?
Well, I think, you know, the discussions there are much, much longer than just having this as part of the trade discussions with Trump. But again, because this is also about much more long-term strategic decisions, it will feature in that as well. Again, this trade dispute and the trade war that we're seeing right now is really not so much about trade. It is about much larger structural issues and perhaps a global, you know, big power rivalry.
What does the VAT tax dynamic mean? They're going to reduce the VAT tax for manufacturing in China?
Well, I think, you know, it's certainly meant to improve economic prospects as China is entering this period of showing signs of weakness. And, you know, the Trump administration is very well aware of that, and things are part of them being in a much stronger negotiating position.
John, this is really important because, you know, at Heathrow, they've got the line there for the VAT tax checkout. For Americans, the whole VAT tax thing is like wicked foreign. In our collective memory is in Canada, they tried to do a VAT tax and it literally brought down the government at one point.
Well, very destructive. You know, VAT taxes are very destructive for the poorest in society, typically.
And I mean, that's what really struck me in the Chinese announcement.
Yeah, but it's for manufacturing. It's for a specific sector.
It's for a specific sector.
Marianne, just in terms of what is happening in China, how much of it is engineered by the Chinese, the domestic slowdown, and how much of it is engineered by the U.S. administration?
Well, I think so far it is mostly about the domestic issues in China primarily, because the tariffs and the retaliatory tariffs, they are significant, but really overall in the scheme of things, it's minor. And so even though obviously for the prospects of economic growth, this delay of tariffs and, you know, also no longer talking about additional tariffs of $267 billion, that is certainly positive, but I wouldn't overestimate the impact that it's had.
Marianne, it's been really interesting over the last couple of weeks, this narrative that has built up, fueled by events in the Oval Office, that there seems to be a spread between the deal the President of the United States wants and the deal that some of his China hawks would ultimately like. Is that just a narrative? Is that just a false perception of what is happening? Or do you think there's something to that?
Well, I think there's something to this, because there's various priorities that the Trump administration has raised when it comes to trade with China. For the president, it seems to be mostly about forcing China to reduce the bilateral trade surplus with the United States. And here it's important to keep in mind that China accounts for about 60% of the U.S.'s global trade deficit. But various concerns about, you know, this focus on the bilateral trade deficit that is really misguided. Whereas others in the administration, in particular Robert Lighthizer, the United States Trade Representative, his concern is much more about those structural issues. So tackling unfair trade practices when it comes to forced technology transfer, IP theft. And I think on that point, the Trump administration has much, much more legitimate concerns, but the methods to address those are wrong. So tariffs aren't really going to do much about it. Much more importantly would be to build a global alliance, so for the United States to work together with the EU and Japan to jointly force China to change their practices. And to some extent, we're seeing that the US, the EU, and Japan have had trilateral talks and have issued a number of statements over the last year. So there is potential opportunity for collaboration.
Marianne, I often hear this, that tariffs aren't the right way forward. But what's interesting to me is that the status quo, what we had before, the traditional approach of getting the Chinese to do what everyone thought the Chinese should do wasn't working either. What is pretty interesting is the Chinese are actually at the table now. So quite clearly, tariffs to some degree are working, Marianne. It's got the Chinese to come to the table and consider doing things that they have talked about doing but haven't done for a long time.
Again, it's a negotiating tactic, and yes, you're absolutely right that that has worked in terms of bringing the Chinese to the table. Now, the key question is, what will come after this? Are we just going to see a quick deal that leaves many of those issues that are structural, just in limbo and kind of adds to this lingering uncertainty? And the other question is also, will it be tough enough to actually have an enforcement mechanism? Will that have peace? And that, I think, is not yet quite clear.
Marianne, thank you so much. Marianne Schneider-Petzinger with Chatham House this morning. We greatly appreciate her attendance.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more. Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Daniel Katz is with us with BNP Paribas. And this is an important conversation on foreign exchange. Daniel, with all the news on China, give us an update on renminbi dynamics. What do we need to know about the president all upset about Chinese manipulation? Give us a BNP Paribas brief on that with BNP Paribas' legacy in China.
Well, I think, from the U.S. perspective, there's been a longstanding press to get dollar China moving in a more market-driven way. Lately, though, the message that we're getting from press reports, at least, is that there may be some room for an agreement with China to kind of allow the currency to be stable around the current range as part of the trade talks that are happening.
So it's a managed currency. It's still it's not a floating currency.
I mean, it's increasingly more market determined for sure, and it moves much more than it did 10 years ago or so, but it has still aspects of a managed currency.
Okay, Daniel, with your great experience, I want to get the dollar ambiguity right now. What is a BNP Paribas call on the U.S. dollar?
Structurally weaker over the next year or two. We think as the Fed, continues to be on hold and the markets start to prepare for Fed easing at some point, the dollar is going to be very vulnerable. For now, though, we're in a very pro-carry environment across markets. Volatility has fallen across markets. Investors are looking for carry-type strategies. And within the G10, the dollar benefits as a higher yielding currency.
That's called doing a Kansas jargon alert. Carry on, my wayward son. What is carry? Mm-hmm. What is carry?
Well, it's simply the strategies that look for a higher yielding asset at a time when market volatility is low. When volatility is low, it's a good strategy to look for yield, and investors like those types of strategies. The danger is that at some point volatility picks up very quickly, and you see a rush to exit from positions like that.
Any reason for vol to pick up anytime soon, Dan?
Well, we can think of any number of things that could be disturbing for markets. And it seems, sometimes strange that volatilities are so low given all the uncertainties we see in trade policy, geopolitics, the economic outlook, et cetera. So it wouldn't be hard to make a list of things that could jar the market out of their current level of low volatility.
Fascinating to see cross-asset vol drive lower, Tom, in the way it has done.
Yeah,
Since the Federal Reserve's retreat, not just in foreign exchange, but in treasuries as well. And it leads me to an important question that a lot of people I know are asking, Dan. We've actually been very range-bound in the FX market, in the treasury market as well. Do you think we stay in that range, Dan, or are you thinking about other things? Walk me through your thinking right now.
So for now, all the G10 central banks have signaled patience and a desire to be on hold, and that's brought volatility down across these asset markets, and it's very hard to see those ranges in G10 FX breaking. Over the more medium term, maybe beyond a month or two, we think the dollar is at very elevated levels, so there is scope for a big move lower, which would mean these ranges break on the dollar weak side. And we think that'll happen probably in the second half of the year. But it could happen very quickly. Once it starts, it could happen very quickly.
Could President Draghi stand in the way of that?
There's not a lot of ammunition on the ECB side. They've already effectively gone on hold in their signaling. They could reinforce that a bit. But the ECB is in a situation where policy never really normalized, so it was very accommodative. It's hard to signal additional easing at this point, and they don't have the ability to say, we're going to tighten less because market's already pricing very little tightening. So he doesn't have a lot of ammunition.
Daniel, what is your optimal play right now? There's a jumble, and I was really taken by the set of Chinese announcements today. But do you recalibrate here, or do you have a trade that you've got a real belief in?
Well, I think we have to respect the push for carry that we're seeing across markets. And so we want to participate in that dynamic, but we want to do it in a way that we're not taking big valuation risk, because there's kind of this contradiction between wanting to be long the dollar because it's a high yielder and being scared that the dollar is going to fall back to more longer-term equilibrium. We think dollar-Swiss is one pair where there is carry and where you don't have the valuation risk that you have in other dollar pairs. So we think being exposed to dollar-Swiss upside makes sense in the current environment of that we're going to see over the next quarter.
Dan, all of these trades that you're describing make me believe that what you see is an economy that reaccelerates in the months to come. Is that your base case, Dan, and why?
Well, it's not really. I don't think reacceleration is what we're looking for. It's more stabilization at below trend rate of growth in the U.S. So it's not fast enough for the Fed to resume hikes. At the same time, it's not slow enough to get the markets really concerned about crash risk and pricing policy easing, et cetera,
right.
in the G10.
What is the bet now on dollar? You've got some great charts showing belief in long dollar, short dollar, or dollar stronger, I should say, dollar weaker. What's the belief of the street right now?
I think if you look across the consensus of most forecasters, it's that the dollar will be weaker over time. And that's, I think, a reflection of the relatively high valuation that we have on most of the dollar pairs. And we think that makes sense. I just think for now, don't be surprised if the dollar continues to hold stable and does better than the forwards would imply. In other words, you can make money being long USD because of the yield differential. But as I mentioned, dollar Swiss is a safer way to do that than euro dollar, for example.
Great. Dan Katzoff, thank
Smart
you so
stuff,
much.
Dan.
BNP Paribas. Just a
thank
nice,
you.
Nice update there. It is good to check in with Stephen Whiting of Citi Private Bank. With a real tour of duty in economics and in a strategy, their chief investment strategist. What is the new Stephen Whiting strategy, Steve?
Well, it's to prepare for a U.S. outlook where the Federal Reserve switches from trying to restrain the strength of the expansion to protect the expansion we're in. And right now, particularly in Asia, what's relevant is China is moving fairly strongly, regardless of how these trade negotiations work out, but fairly strongly to reinvigorate its economy. It stopped tightening policy about a year ago and has been at a while reinvigorating the strength of the expansion right now. So that combination of lower policy rates in the United States, or at least planned where they would be, and China's stimulus really changes a lot of asset movements potentially around the world over the coming year.
Buried in your, we were just talking about this with John Tucker, who, what are you in like the 87% marginal bracket? Is it 87%?
Whatever's the worst, that's where
it's like Rockefellerian or something
that.
You've got, Steve Whiting, an important phrase in your Citibank report, the absence of tax cuts.
Right.
Did we have tax cuts?
Well, we did last year, and it depends on how you feel about them in this tax filing season, because we have a little bit of uncertainty as to how large the effective tax cut was for different people, especially folks in states that have high personal income tax rates and property tax rates.
That have a dog named Biscuit.
Yeah, but you just take a look. We put a figure in there. You're really great with charts, Tom. But if you looked at sort of overall personal income last year, we were continued at a decent clip. But the personal tax liability overall grew very, very little. And they usually move together. And that, again, is the tax cut. And we know that the corporate tax cut, for example, was pretty powerful. And I do believe that there are some lasting benefits of the corporate tax cut. But the immediate boost to income that that had is just simply not repeated this year. So you've got to look back at the U.S. economy's performance with about a 3% growth rate last year and say probably the single largest spur to that growth rate was tax cuts, and we don't have another one.
And did you hear that, John? We don't have another one, which means you're up 9% next year.
So, Stephen, you know, you mentioned China, and boy, they've been pretty aggressive with the fiscal stimulus of late. Is it any sense of whether it's working or it will work? What are your thoughts there?
It's all new. That sort of, you know, financial implications looking forward, those things we can measure a few things. For example, in January, we had the largest increase in CNY loans in the history of China. This VAT tax that they just announced, near $300 billion U.S. dollar equivalent, that is all prospective. There are some things that are still going to slow in China's economy. Export growth, for example, we was pulled forward by the threat of tariffs. So the desire to order from China ahead of paying tariffs was very strong, and it boosted trade activity in 2018, and there's still some slowing there. But things that did slow internally in China are sometimes even more important. And credit restraint was very severe in 2017 into early 2018. And so things that underperformed were very domestic, like infrastructure spending in the early part of 2018. And that is gradually going to be coming back now.
So, Stephen, it's interesting. Tom and I just earlier today were just talking about the dollar and the strength of the dollar, and we're having a very hard time coming up with a bear case for the dollar, or at least even a less bullish case for the dollar. What is your view on the dollar right here?
Well, look, we thought this year would be a little bit like last year in terms of it being relatively range-bound. But the history here is that between 2011 and early 2017, we had the third largest U.S. dollar bull market on record. The dollar is up at a fairly high level. We have had 9 rate hikes out of the United States, and the rest of the world, anyone who hiked, didn't really want to. And we're at the point now where the Federal Reserve had some real warnings about activity last year. We saw housing activity, construction and sales, fall for a year. Now, not a lot, not a level sort of that says it's impossible for us to come back from this. But remember, we also had a tax cut, and we saw banks tightening lending standards in the fourth quarter. So it's all sorts of signs that we couldn't stay on the same tightening trajectory in the United States. And so when it turns, there's a very good chance here that we peak out of the dollar. Now, one little complication is, you know, dollar-euro, or are we talking dollar-China? And that's a very, very different story.
Steve Whiting, thank you so much for the update with Citi Private Bank as well. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.